At over 1,000 pages, Paul Auster's 4321 is the longest book on the shortlist. Not that this stopped the 70-year-old American author from narrating the audiobook version himself. He joined Robert down the line from his home in New York. But first, here's a clip.
4321, a novel by Paul Auster. According to family legend, Ferguson's grandfather departed on foot from his native city of Minsk with 100 rubles sewn into the lining of his jacket, traveled west to Hamburg through Warsaw and Berlin, and then booked passage on a ship called the Empress of China, which crossed the Atlantic in rough winter storms and sailed into New York Harbor on the first day of the 20th century. While waiting to be interviewed by an immigration official at Ellis Island, he struck up a conversation with a fellow Russian Jew. The man said to him, "Forget the name Reznikov. It won't do you any good here. You need an American name for your new life in America, something with a good American ring to it." Since English was still an alien tongue to Isaac Reznikov in 1900, he asked his older, more experienced compatriot for a suggestion. "Tell them you're Rockefeller," the man said. "You can't go wrong with that." An hour passed, then another hour, and by the time the 19-year-old Reznikov sat down to be questioned by the immigration official, he had forgotten the name the man had told him to give. "Your name?" the official asked. Slapping his head in frustration, the weary immigrant blurted out in Yiddish, "Ich hab vergessen," I've forgotten. And so it was that Isaac Reznikov began his new life in America as Ichabod Ferguson.
The book is a novel. I finished it last year. It's by far the longest novel I've ever written. It's the manuscript I remember was over 1,100 pages. I think the British edition is close to 900, but now in the new paperback it's over 1,000. They've changed the format, so it's a big book. And what it tells, essentially, is the story of a young man's life from birth to young adulthood. But what I do in the book is I tell the story four different ways, four different parallel lives for the same person whose name is Archie Ferguson. And that's why the book is so long, because, in fact, it's four novels in one.
Did you write each Ferguson individually, or did you write them the way we read it?
No, I wrote it the way you read it, because whenever I write a novel, I start at the beginning and I write the first sentence and then the second sentence and then the third and all the way to the end, because I don't always know what I'm doing, and I need to have the material behind me in order to do the material I'm doing that day. And so I needed to just write it in the order in which you read it.
Now, you say it's a novel, but there are people from your life in it and things that you've experienced in it. So there's part, I don't want to use the word autobiography, but there's autobiographical moments.
Just a few, actually. Even though Archie resembles me in many ways, it's more the fact that we share the same chronology and the same geography. He was born the same year I was. He lives in the same place as I did, and later moved to the cities where I've lived myself. But essentially, it's a work of fiction with a few actual events transformed into fiction in the novel. But this is true, I think, for all novelists all the time in every book.
I'm thinking about the Columbia sit-ins.
Yes, I was a student at Columbia, no question about it, at the same time that Ferguson is. But unlike Ferguson, I was not a reporter for the student newspaper. That's something that he does in the novel. So he's reporting on the big revolution of 1968 that took place there. And yes, I did put some real people in there because I thought it was necessary. For example, the leader of the student radical group who led the strike against the university was someone named Mark Rudd, who was someone actually I knew all the way back in high school, and then we went to the same university also. And I asked Mark if I could use his name, and he said, fine. And so I did. But at the time, Mark became a very prominent figure in American life. I think he even had his picture on the cover of Newsweek around that time. So he was a known quantity, and I didn't want to fictionalize him.
Now, you said earlier it's a long book, and in turn, of course, it's a long audiobook. 36 hours are
36 and a half hours, I was told.
Now, anyone who doesn't know will think, yes, sitting reading isn't hard, but we know it's intellectually that's a challenge. How was the reading process for you?
It was stretched over 3 weeks. It was, I remember, last August, so a little over a year ago, and I would trek into Manhattan. I live in Brooklyn, so I'd trek into Manhattan every day in the sweltering heat and squish myself into a tiny, tiny studio. It was so small I couldn't even stretch out my legs, and just proceeded to read. And I have to say, one of the things that kept me going was that I have a friend who's a very interesting man who lives in the Midwest, and he spent his life publishing handmade books of mostly poetry, a wonderful person. And this friend is suffering from macular degeneration, and man who spent his whole life reading is no longer able to read. And all through those days, I kept thinking about my friend, Walter Hamady, and that I was actually reading the book for him. And it helped get me through it, I have to say, because I wanted him very much to hear it, because he wasn't any longer able to read it himself. I'm a great believer in spoken word books, the audio books. I have many friends who find it difficult to read for one reason or another, not just poor sight or no sight, but, for example, a number of artists that I know are not great readers, but they like books. And some of them actually listen to my books while they're painting during the day. And I find that very, very nice. And other people enjoy listening to books while they're driving their cars, either commuters or people on long-distance trips. And again, I hear from people who say how inspiring they find these audiobooks. It's not a performance, reading a book out loud. It's somehow entering into the rhythms of the prose and articulating it clearly enough so that the listener can grasp what's on the page in his or her ears.
When you're writing, do you stop and read it to yourself as well to find that rhythm?
Yes, I do it all the time. And in fact, I've been married for 36 years to Siri Hustvedt, also a writer, a wonderfully brilliant writer. And all these years, I've always read out loud to her as I'm writing a book. Every 20, 30, or 40 pages, I sit down with her and I read the most recent pages, and it helps me to hear where I've gone wrong. And without reading it out loud, I don't think I would comprehend what I've done as well. So it's very important to me. Because writing is a physical activity as much as a mental one, and hearing it articulated by a human voice is essential.
Back to the story. The story is all about what ifs. Did you think about the little decisions in your life and how it's ended up to...
Oh, absolutely. I mean, doesn't everybody? I think what we're talking about, these what ifs, are things that everybody at one time or another thinks about, especially perhaps as you get a little older and you look back on the things that have happened to you. Not only the decisions you've made, but the circumstances that have turned your life in this direction or that. And it's quite remarkable to think about how, for example, I was talking about Siri, my wife, a moment ago. When I met her 36 years ago, she was an absolute stranger to me. And there was only one person in the world we knew in common. And I happened to go to an event at which he was there with her. They were fellow students at Columbia University, and he introduced me to her. Now, if I hadn't gone that night And I was very tempted not to go, I remember. I never would have met her, which means not only would the last 36 years have been entirely different, but our 30-year-old daughter never would have been born. And it's difficult not to think about these things whenever you look back on the past.
Now, we're talking today because of the Booker Prize. Now, as an American writer, how aware of the Booker Prize were you?
Oh, no, very aware. It's something that everyone, at least in the English-speaking world, has known about for years. And even in America, they've always made a big deal of it when the winner is announced. So, yes, and I think it's quite wonderful now that Americans qualify, because it becomes truly a prize for the whole English-speaking world, and there's nothing like it. And I think in Spain they have the Cervantes Prize, which is similar. It's the entire Spanish-speaking world, whether Spain or South America. And so now English has an equivalent, and I think it's very impressive.
He had a hard time of it, especially in the beginning. But even after it was no longer the beginning, nothing ever went as he had imagined it would in his adopted country. It was true that he managed to find a wife for himself just after his 26th birthday. And it was also true that this wife, Fanny, née Grossman, bore him three robust and healthy sons. But life in America remained a struggle for Ferguson's grandfather from the day he walked off the boat until the night of March 7th, 1923, when he met an early, unexpected death at the age of 42, gunned down in a holdup at the leather goods warehouse in Chicago, where he'd been employed as a night watchman.
Another clip of Paul Auster reading from his novel 4321, which is TB 24153. Thanks to Robert and to Paul Auster.